Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
It's great to have you with us. Today, we're doing something pretty ambitious, a really thorough, comprehensive, MECE, exhaustive and detailed look through today's most critical news and market movements.
That's right. And our source material for this deep dive is specifically the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, November 5th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal, as always, is to really dig in, extract those key insights, and connect the dots between, you know, the big corporate fights and the broader political and social stories shaping things right now.
Absolutely. And maybe the best place to start is the market backdrop, because it really sets the scene. When you look at the activity, there's this interesting tension, almost cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface, you see some okay numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, it managed to climb up about 0.53%. And the NASDAQ actually had a pretty impressive day, jumping 2.0%.
Yeah, but those headline numbers can be a bit deceiving, can't they? If you broaden the view, look at the indices over a slightly longer period, major U.S. stocks actually retreated overall. The S&P 500, it slid 1.2% for the day.
Right.
And the NASDAQ composite, even with that spike you mentioned, well, it finished the day down a full 2%. The Dow also ended the week down about 0.5%.
So what's driving that split, that disconnect?
Well, it seems to be this underlying tension. There's just massive, massive amounts of capital pouring into artificial intelligence right now. And that's actually making investors pretty nervous, particularly about valuations in the tech sector. Are they getting ahead of themselves?
And you can actually see that nervousness quantified, right, in the VIX.
Exactly. The VIX, you know, Wall Street's fear gauge, it jumped pretty dramatically. And that's the key signal. When you see the fear index spiking at the same time as huge tech investments are being made, it suggests the market is really struggling. Struggling to convince itself that future revenues can possibly justify the spending we're seeing today.
It's a high wire act.
It really is.
Yeah.
High stakes, high volatility environment. Caution seems to be the word. We also saw the 10-year Treasury yield dip just a little to 4.090%, which shows there's still demand for safer assets. And oil prices crept up a bit to $60.56 a barrel.
Okay, so that volatile backdrop, it definitely sets the stage for some of the stories we're digging into, especially these incredibly risky, high-premium corporate bets being made.
Yeah, and the first one is just, wow, we have to talk about the weight loss drug frenzy. It's now exploded into this really extraordinary bidding war over a company called Metsera. And it's getting litigious, too.
Metsera, this is a company that's only, what, 3 years old?
3 years old. Just over 100 employees, and this is the kicker. Zero approved drugs. None. Yet it's somehow become the center of this massive takeover fight between two pharmaceutical giants, Novo Nordisk and Pfizer.
It's almost unbelievable. And the numbers involved are just staggering. They really scream desperation, don't they?
They really do. Novo Nordisk, which is already a big player in this space, they raised their bid. It could be up to $86.20 per share. That values Metsera at around $10
billion. $10 billion for a company with no sales.
Exactly. And Pfizer, not wanting to be left out, quickly countered. They raised their offer to up to $70 per share, which is about $8.1 billion.
Mm.
And remember, Pfizer's trying to top its own previous agreement, which was already at $7.3 billion.
They're bidding against themselves, almost.
In a way, yeah. And let's just pause on that initial Novo Nordisk bid,
yep.
The $86.20 one. That represented a premium of, get this, 159% over Metsera's closing price back in September, just before the first Pfizer deal was even announced.
159%. That's not just high. That's astronomical.
It's bordering on irrational, right?
Yeah.
It suggests pricing driven purely by existential need. The question isn't just why the weight loss market is so big, and it is, $72 billion now, projected maybe $139 billion by 2030. The real question is why this specific company, with no approved drugs, justifies that kind of price tag.
So what's the thinking there? The sources hint it's not just about the obesity drugs themselves. Metsera has a monthly injectable and some pills in development. Is it something else, like proprietary tech or really promising early data?
That seems to be the bet. Maybe they have some unique mechanism of action or a dosing schedule that looks superior based on phase one or two data. For Novo Nordisk, well, their own internal research hasn't thrilled investors lately. They seem desperate to bolster their pipeline, especially to compete against Eli Lilly, who's currently leading the pack.
Okay, so Novo's playing catch-up. What about Pfizer? Why are they willing to pay so much?
For Pfizer, it feels like an urgent need for growth, especially after COVID. You know, they're big earners, Paxlovid and the Comirnaty vaccine. Those sales are falling off steeply.
Right.
They've tried before to develop their own weight loss pill, one that's easy to mass produce, and they haven't succeeded. So grabbing Metsera's pipeline looks like their attempt to buy a shortcut into this huge new market.
Hmm.
The price seems almost secondary to securing that future market share.
And because the stakes are just so incredibly high, Pfizer isn't just walking away after being outbid. They're fighting back hard, legally.
Right. This is where it gets really messy. Pfizer has filed two separate lawsuits trying to challenge Novo Nordisk's higher bid.
Yeah.
It's turning into a real legal grudge match.
Okay, what are the two suits?
So the first one is in Delaware's Chancery Court. They're basically trying to stop Metsera from walking away from their existing merger agreement with Pfizer. Pfizer is arguing that Novo's competing offer is illusory, which is a pretty bold claim, essentially questioning if the Novo bid is even valid or achievable.
Wow. Okay. And the second lawsuit, you mentioned antitrust.
Exactly. Pfizer filed another suit, this one in federal court, against both Metsera and Novo Nordisk. Here, they're arguing that letting Novo buy Metsera would violate federal antitrust laws.
Their argument being that combining Novo, a major player, with this really promising startup would kill competition in this super important, fast-growing market.
Precisely. Metsera, for its part, is pushing back, telling the court, Pfizer is just trying to interfere improperly in what should be a normal bidding process, maybe even trying to bully Pfizer into raising its own bid again if the courts don't step in. It's just a hugely expensive, unusually public fight over intellectual property and, really, market survival.
It's an incredible corporate drama. And speaking of extraordinary corporate dramas, we absolutely have to shift gears and talk about Tesla. Specifically, this proposed $1 trillion pay package for Elon Musk.
Yeah, this story really blew up when Norway's sovereign wealth fund came out and publicly rejected the package. Now, this isn't just any investor. They're the sixth largest institutional investor in Tesla. They hold about 1.2% of the company. So when they say no, it sends a really serious signal to everyone else.
And they weren't vague about why, were they? They laid out specific reasons.
No, they were quite specific. They basically flagged three main concerns, reflecting a pretty traditional corporate governance perspective. First, just the sheer mind-boggling size of the award itself.
$1 trillion is hard to comprehend.
Right. Second, the very real risk of dilution for all the existing shareholders if this package goes through. And third, and this is crucial from a governance standpoint, they felt it lacked any real mitigation for key person risk.
Key person risk, meaning the risk that if Musk leaves, the company tanks.
Exactly. Their point is, if you tie that much value to one single individual, you're massively concentrating your risk. What happens if he walks away or gets hit by a bus, metaphorically speaking?
But isn't the counter argument that the package itself is designed to mitigate that risk by tying that insane payout to equally insane milestones that arguably only Musk could achieve? Let's break down those conditions because they really are staggering.
Yeah, the structure is less like typical compensation and more like a decade-long high-stakes performance contract with goals that seem almost impossible today. Musk only gets the full whack, the full share award, if Tesla reaches an $8.5 trillion valuation.
$8.5 trillion, just for context, what is that compared to now?
It's nearly eight times Tesla's current valuation. It's roughly the combined market caps of Apple, Microsoft, and Google put together right now.
Okay, so beyond just the stock price, there are huge operational goals too.
Massive ones. Things like delivering 20 million vehicles a year, deploying 1 million robotaxis into active service, and reaching a 3-month average of 10 million subscribers for Tesla's full self-driving service. It really is, as you said, like a corporate mission statement turned into a pay plan.
It's audacious. So you have Norway and others opposing it. Who's supporting it?
Well, the opposition is definitely strong. You've got smaller pension funds like the American Federation of Teachers and the big proxy advisory firms ISS and Glass Lewis recommending a no vote. But the support is also notable, and it comes from a different philosophical place. Charles Schwab and Morgan Stanley's Counterpoint Global Fund, for example, have said they'll vote in favor.
So their thinking must be that this isn't really an expense, but more like insurance to keep Musk engaged.
That seems to be the argument. That the risk of diluting existing shareholders, while real, is actually less than the risk of losing Musk's unique vision and drive. This whole fight really captures this fundamental tension in modern corporate governance.
Yeah.
How do you possibly put a price tag on a singular visionary founder CEO versus the traditional rights and concerns of shareholders?
It's a really profound question. Can traditional governance metrics even handle someone like Musk? A yes vote is essentially a bet that only this kind of unprecedented structure can keep the person they believe is necessary to even have a shot at that $8.5 trillion target.
Exactly. It's a defining moment, really, for how we think about corporate leadership and shareholder power in these founder-led tech giants.
Okay, so from the boardroom battles, let's pivot to Washington, D.C. There's another potentially trillion-dollar fight playing out, this one at the Supreme Court. It's over the legality of President Trump's huge Liberation Day tariffs.
Yeah, this case, Learning Resources Inc. v. Trump, this could be one of the most significant constitutional challenges the court faces this term, because it boils down to a fundamental question. Can the president essentially bypass Congress and use a law designed for sanctions to completely reshape the U.S. economy through tariffs?
Let's unpack the legal basis here. The administration didn't use the typical trade laws, like Section 301 for unfair practices or Section 232 for national security, like they did with steel tariffs. They used something different, didn't they?
That's the absolute core of it. They invoked the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, known as IEEPA.
IEEPA, and that's normally used for?
It's fundamentally a sanctions law. It's designed for targeted actions against hostile nations or specific individuals during genuine sudden crises. Think freezing the assets of, you know, North Korean banks or Russian oligarchs.
Okay, so how did they justify using that law for broad tariffs on almost everything?
Well, the administration's argument was that the persistent large U.S. goods trade deficit constitutes an unusual and extraordinary threat to national security and the economy. And that threat, they argued, justifies using IEEPA's emergency powers to impose these sweeping tariffs, ranging from 10% up to 49% on basically all imported goods from nearly all countries.
It sounds audacious. Using a targeted emergency law to address a decades-old structural economic issue like the trade deficit.
That's precisely what the lower courts found so problematic. Three different lower courts have already ruled against these tariffs. Their reasoning was pretty clear. IEEPA was intended for surgical, targeted sanctions, not for these unbounded, non-emergency tariffs covering almost every product from everywhere.
Did they point out anything specific in the law itself?
Yeah, the judges noted that IEEPA doesn't even mention tariffs as one of the tools the president can use under the act. So if the Supreme Court were to side with the president here, it would essentially legitimize using IEEPA as a kind of general-purpose economic weapon.
Which would have huge implications for the balance of power between Congress and the president.
Huge. It could allow future presidents to completely sidestep Congress's constitutional authority over foreign commerce. They could potentially impose tariffs using IEEPA for all sorts of non-economic reasons, maybe drug trafficking or immigration disputes, things far removed from the law's original intent.
The long-term stakes are massive, but there's also a very immediate, very practical problem. What about all the money already collected? How much are we talking about?
We're talking about roughly $90 billion collected just through August of this year. That's the refund dilemma. If the administration ultimately loses this case at the Supreme Court, importers who paid those tariffs would legally be entitled to refunds.
$90 billion. Refunding, that sounds complicated.
That's exactly what the administration is arguing. They've told the court that setting up a refund program of that sheer scale would be, quote, impossible to execute. They're warning about dire consequences for the U.S. Treasury and the wider economy if they're forced to pay it back, essentially arguing that the difficulty of fixing the problem is a reason not to rule against them in the first place.
Is that impossible claim really credible, though, or is it more of a pressure tactic?
Well, legal and trade experts, like those cited from the Cato Institute, they push back strongly on that. They argue that large-scale duty refunds are actually quite doable. U.S. Customs uses specific tariff codes for everything, so they could likely execute automatic refunds based on those codes. It sounds more like a political and economic threat than a genuine administrative impossibility.
Right. And there are geopolitical angles, too. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent mentioned something about world leaders.
Yes. Bessent warned the court that the earlier lower court rulings against the administration had already caused problems. He said world leaders started questioning the president's authority to follow through on trade threats, which apparently led to delays or even countries walking away from important trade negotiations that were kind of underpinned by the threat of these very tariffs.
So the administration needs these tariffs, or the threat of them, to maintain leverage. Do they have a backup plan if they lose at the Supreme Court?
It seems they do. They've reportedly got contingency plans ready. One is to expand the use of Section 232. That's the national security authority they used for steel and aluminum tariffs to cover more goods as a sort of backstop.
Okay.
And they're also apparently considering using a provision from the Trade Act of 1974, Section 122, which has basically never been used before. It allows for temporary tariffs, up to 15% for 150 days, specifically to address trade imbalances. That could buy them time to figure out a more permanent solution using other existing trade laws if IEPA gets struck down.
So the Supreme Court's decision here is really pivotal. It could either reaffirm Congress's role in trade or hand the executive branch a massive new economic power.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental decision about the structure of U.S. economic power on the world stage.
Okay, moving from that potential constitutional crisis to a very real ongoing governmental crisis.
Yeah.
The shutdown. It's still going on.
Still going. And it just hit a pretty grim milestone. This government shutdown is now tied for the longest ever at 35 days. Most non-essential federal activity is just ground to a halt.
Is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Senate Majority Leader John Thune proposed some kind of path forward.
Thune outlined what he sees as maybe the only viable way to reopen the government right now. It's what you might call a linkage strategy.
Okay, linking what to what?
He's proposing linking a short-term spending bill, which would get the government reopened with a separate later vote on extending the Affordable Care Act, ACA, subsidies that are set to expire.
Ah, the ACA subsidies. That's been the big sticking point for Democrats, hasn't it? Senator Schumer's been demanding that extension since September.
Exactly. So Thune's challenge is basically one of trust. Will Democrats, led by Schumer, trust the Republican leadership enough to accept just the promise of a future vote on the ACA subsidies? Or will they insist that the extension have to be baked into the funding bill itself before they'll agree to reopen the government? Trust, or maybe the lack of it, that's really the currency in this negotiation right now.
And this whole deadlock got even uglier with that controversy around federal food aid, SNAP benefits.
Yeah, that was really contentious. The accusation was that the administration was trying to use aid for the poor as political leverage.
What happened exactly?
Well, President Trump initially threatened to block the funding for SNAP, that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps, basically until Democrats agreed to his terms for reopening the government. He publicly stated benefits would only go out once the government was funded.
That sounds like an extreme tactic, using essential aid like that.
It was perceived that way, yeah.
Okay.
Weaponizing aid for vulnerable people in a political fight. But that threat didn't last long.
Oh.
The White House reversed course pretty quickly, specifically after a court order came down last Friday. The press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, announced the president was, quote, fully complying with that court order. The order mandated the administration had to use emergency funds, funds normally set aside for catastrophes or war, to cover SNAP benefits during the shutdown.
So the immediate threat to benefits was averted by the court?
Yes. But the fact that the administration was even willing to go there to leverage such fundamental aid in a political negotiation, that probably caused some lasting damage and distrust, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. D.C. has certainly seen its share of political theater lately, but maybe nothing quite matches the sheer surreal quality of this assault by sandwich trial that started this week.
Right. This case, it sounds almost comical on the surface, but it actually taps into some really serious underlying tensions. Specifically, the whole controversy around deploying federal agents like Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, into American cities. Opponents call it the militarization of local law enforcement.
And the defendant, Sean Dunn, he used to work for the Justice Department, and he's charged with misdemeanor assault for throwing a Subway sandwich.
That's the charge. Throwing a Subway sandwich at a CBP agent's bulletproof vest during a protest last year.
Okay. The details from the agent's testimony were pretty memorable.
Oh, yeah. The agent, Gregory Lairmore, he's a 23-year CBP veteran. He testified that he actually felt the impact of the sandwich through his vest. He described it, quote, exploding all over, leaving mustard on his uniform, and apparently an onion inconveniently stuck to his radio antenna.
An onion on the antenna? You can't make this stuff up. The defense tried to downplay it, though.
They did. They pointed to a photo that supposedly showed the sandwich still mostly intact inside its wrapper after hitting the vest, trying to argue it wasn't much of a physical threat.
But their main argument isn't really about the physical impact, is it? They're framing this as political speech.
Exactly. That's the core of the defense. Dunn's lawyer called the sandwich toss a harmless gesture at the end of him exercising his right to speak out. They're arguing Dunn was protesting what he viewed as the militarization and the takeover of local law enforcement by federal agents, and also what he saw as racist immigration policies.
So it's a fascinating clash. Free speech versus assault, played out with a foot long.
It really is. It shows how in these supercharged political moments, even a relatively minor incident can become this high-profile symbol, testing the boundaries between protest and maintaining order.
And the agent himself seemed to acknowledge the absurdity of it all.
Yeah. Agent Larimore admitted under questioning that his co-workers had given him a hard time about it. He apparently received gag gifts, including a sandwich-shaped plush toy, and even a patch that read, "Felony Footlong."
Felony Footlong? Wow.
It just goes to show, in today's environment, even a flying sandwich can become freighted with all this political meaning and social friction.
Okay, so from the courtroom drama in D.C., let's shift focus now. Let's talk about how these massive, almost unimaginable investments in artificial intelligence are literally changing the American landscape, both, you know, geographically and economically.
Yeah, the scale of spending on AI infrastructure right now is just staggering. And it's creating these entirely new economic hubs in places you'd never expect. Take Umatilla, Oregon, for example.
Umatilla, wasn't that mostly known for, like, a chemical weapons depot?
Exactly. That and a state prison. Pretty remote, not exactly an economic powerhouse, but now it's become this unlikely center for one of the most expensive infrastructure buildouts in U.S. history, all driven by Amazon building more and more data centers there.
So this is the data center boom in action, turning these overlooked towns into instant boom towns. What does that actually look like on the ground?
It's incredibly disruptive in both good and bad ways. Home prices in Umatilla have basically doubled the city's annual budget. It's exploded. Went from about $7 million back in 2011 to $144 million in the last fiscal year.
Wow.
And the city government itself has had to more than double its staff just to treat and manage this huge influx of money and development.
Is Amazon helping with the infrastructure needed?
Very much so. Amazon Web Services is effectively acting like a sort of parallel government there. Mm-hmm. They're financing essential projects, roads, water systems that the small city just couldn't afford on its own otherwise. And that new revenue stream from the data centers, it's paying for things like brand new school facilities. You've got local real estate agents suddenly making serious money, kind of minting new middle class residents.
But it can't all be positive, right? There have to be downsides to that kind of rapid change.
Oh, absolutely. The sources talk about steep trade-offs. There's a real sense of loss, the erosion of that small town feel as contractors and workers flood in, and costs are soaring.
Housing, childcare.
Both rising so fast that many longtime blue-collar residents are getting priced out. And there are big public arguments now about how to handle all this new money should they save it, spend it immediately. The fundamental tension is between this sudden new prosperity and the potential loss of the town's character and social cohesion. As one city manager put it, though, if your city isn't growing, it's dying. Umatilla is basically betting its future on AI disruption and all.
And maybe the single biggest challenge driving all this massive construction, the biggest pain point, is power, right? The electricity needed for AI.
It's unbelievable. The hunger for electricity from AI data centers is so intense, so massive, that major tech players are now effectively trying to build their own power grids. Which brings us to this startup in Texas involving former Energy Secretary Rick Perry. It's called Fermi.
Fermi? What are they planning?
Fermi, co-founded by Rick Perry and Toby Neugebauer, they're planning something pretty radical. A $17 billion startup aiming to build four large nuclear reactors way out in the Texas panhandle.
Nuclear reactors? To power what?
To power their own gigantic data center campus, planned to be operational by 2038. We're talking about an 11-gigawatt ambition here. That's roughly the amount of power needed for an entire state, like Alabama.
That's incredible. It's basically a statement that they don't think the regular grid can handle AI's demands.
That's exactly the statement. Neugebauer said it explicitly.
Yeah.
The customers they're talking to understand they can no longer rely on grid power for the massive, constant, always-on electricity needed for AI processing. The traditional utility grid just moves too slowly.
But building new nuclear in the U.S. has been notoriously difficult, right? Billions over budget, years behind schedule seems to be the norm. How are they planning to deal with that risk?
It's a huge challenge. For now, they're starting with more immediate solutions. They've secured about 2.5 gigawatts worth of natural gas equipment to bridge the gap for the next couple of years. They're aiming to have a full gigawatt of power online by the end of next year using gas.
So gas first, then nuclear later.
Well, that seems to be the plan. Rick Perry frames this whole endeavor, not just in economic terms, but almost ideologically, as crucial for defending Western civilization through energy dominance. It really signals a profound shift where the biggest power customers are now becoming the power generators themselves out of sheer necessity.
This technological shift, AI, it's driving these huge physical changes, these regulatory fights over power. But the sources suggest the deepest, maybe most politically explosive transformation could be what's happening in the white-collar workforce.
Yeah, this is a really critical insight that comes through in the reading. The widespread push by corporations to use AI for efficiency is leading to a significant and pretty painful wave of white-collar job cuts. These are roles that until recently felt pretty safe.
Like what kinds of roles?
We're seeing examples like Amazon cutting 14,000 corporate jobs, UPS cutting 14,000 management positions, and Chegg, the online learning company, cutting almost half its staff 45% explicitly because AI tools can now do what their service used to do, answering student questions instantly.
And there's a mismatch in the labor market overall.
A huge mismatch. Employers are actually struggling to find enough blue-collar workers, frontline staff. But at the same time, you have this vast pool of college graduates whose skills are more in those softer white-collar areas, things like middle management, basic research, copywriting, tasks that are proving surprisingly easy for AI to automate or significantly optimize.
And this is where the political angle comes in, the comparison to manufacturing job losses.
Exactly. This is the really chilling parallel the source material draws. Mm-hmm. It compares what's happening now in white-collar jobs to the loss of about 5.7 million U.S. manufacturing jobs between roughly 2001 and 2010.
And those manufacturing losses had huge political consequences.
Immense consequences. They didn't just devastate local economies. They fueled this massive wave of political discontent. That discontent powered the Tea Party movement and really laid the ideological groundwork for Donald Trump's rise in 2016.
So the frightening implication here is that if millions of college graduates, people who bought into the whole promise of higher education, often taking on significant debt for expected economic security, find those expectations shattered by AI, they could become the engine for the next big political upheaval.
That's the potential scenario.
Yeah.
How would that disappointment manifest politically? You could end up with a generation of voters who are highly educated, politically aware, maybe already leaning progressive, but now deeply cynical about the economic system that they feel failed them.
What would that look like? A new kind of populism?
It could. Maybe targeting the tech industry itself, or the political elites who promoted globalization and college debt without ensuring the jobs were there at the other end. Disappointed expectations, especially among an educated, vocal group, are incredibly powerful drivers of political change. And unlike the manufacturing losses, which were more geographically concentrated, this white-collar disruption is hitting people everywhere.
And maybe we're already seeing some early signs of this dynamic, this blend of economic anxiety and political mobilization playing out electorally, like in the recent New York City mayoral race.
Absolutely. Zoran Mamdani's victory in NYC felt really significant. A win for the Democratic Socialist Wing, right in the heart of global capitalism. He's the first Muslim mayor of the nation's biggest city, and a big part of his success seemed to be channeling that widespread economic anxiety, especially among younger voters.
His platform was very focused on cost of living, right? Hmm. Affordability.
Intensely focused. That was the core of his appeal. He was promising things like free buses, free childcare up to age 5, and crucially, a rent freeze on rent-stabilized apartments. These are bread and butter issues for working and middle class New Yorkers feeling squeezed.
And he was good at reaching younger voters.
Remarkably effective. Very savvy with social media. He even made videos explaining ranked choice voting using props like, I think, cups of mango lassi. He connected with that exact demographic, younger, educated, likely feeling the pinch of post-college economic reality, the very group we were just talking about.
And this energy wasn't just in New York City. This election cycle was seen as the first big test for President Trump's second term, and Democrats did well elsewhere, too.
And yes, they swept two really key governor's races, flitting the mansions in Virginia and New Jersey. In Virginia, Abigail Spanberger won, becoming the state's first female governor. Her campaign directly challenged Trump on issues like federal workforce turmoil and really hammered home local affordability concerns.
In New Jersey,
Representative Mikey Sherrill won. That victory secured the first time since way back in the 1960s that the same party managed to win a third consecutive gubernatorial term there.
What's interesting is that these are generally considered blue states, Virginia and New Jersey. But the margins were significant.
Very significant. Spanberger won Virginia by about 14 percentage points. Sherrill won New Jersey by 12 points. Those are considerably larger margins than Trump lost by in those states just a year earlier.
So what does that suggest? More than just base enthusiasm.
It could suggest a couple things. Either the Democrats' focus on affordability is really resonating deeply, tapping into that economic anxiety we discussed, or it could signal a definitive backlash against political extremism, maybe leading to a hardening of these blue states. Either way, it sends a clear political message about the electoral landscape heading into the next cycle.
Okay, let's shift perspective now from current political currents to reflecting on the legacy of a major historical figure who passed away this week, Dick Cheney. Former vice president, major security hawk, he was 84.
Yeah, Cheney was, without a doubt, one of the most consequential and certainly one of the most controversial vice presidents in American history. He was really the chief architect behind the scenes of the whole post-9/11 war on terror.
Known for pushing the Iraq invasion in 2003.
Absolutely. Relentless advocacy for that. And also for his strong belief in the unitary executive theory. The idea of almost unlimited presidential power and his defense of controversial policies like enhanced interrogation techniques.
His career spanned decades serving under four Republican presidents. Started incredibly young, right? Youngest White House chief of staff ever for Gerald Ford.
That's right. Only 34 years old. But it's really his deep involvement in Middle East policy across different roles that cements his historical legacy.
Especially regarding Iraq, both wars.
Exactly. People remember the 2003 invasion, but he was also instrumental later in advocating for the 2007 troop surge in Iraq. That was a time when the consensus in Washington was leaning heavily towards a quick withdrawal, maybe like Vietnam. Cheney pushed back hard.
He persuaded President Bush.
He was key in persuading Bush and other doubters at a moment when the situation on the ground was really near collapse. And arguably, the surge did help stabilize the region, at least temporarily. It was successful in beating back both the Iran-backed Shiite insurgents and the hardcore Sunni groups for a time.
So his Iraq legacy is actually more complex than just the initial invasion. He also had success earlier, didn't he, during the first Gulf War as defense secretary?
Yes, under President George H.W. Bush. He was deeply involved in planning that war, including the famous left hook strategy that was so effective in routing the Iraqi military. He was a consistent national security hawk throughout his entire career.
And he defended the 2003 invasion long after leaving office.
He did. He continued to argue it was necessary to prevent another 9/11-style attack, even while acknowledging the unintended consequence might have been increased American skepticism about foreign intervention. It's also worth remembering the personal side. The sources mention him flunking out of Yale twice.
Twice? Wow.
Yeah, and apparently turning his life around after marrying his high school sweetheart, Lynn. And another interesting note. Despite facing fierce criticism from conservatives over the years on various issues, he remained a very public and steadfast supporter of both his daughters, Liz and Mary, regardless of their own political paths or personal lives. A complex figure, no doubt.
That mention of personal well-being provides a good transition, actually, to a huge trend happening right now, this DIY hormone wellness craze. It seems to be really reshaping how people, especially younger women, think about health and even identity.
Yeah, this is a fascinating and slightly concerning trend. It's being massively amplified by social media influencers and wellness brands. The core idea is encouraging women, often in their 20s and 30s, to ditch hormonal birth control and take a completely self-directed, do-it-yourself approach to managing their hormonal health.
How are they doing that? Are they just guessing?
Not exactly guessing, but maybe. Pseudoscience. They often get lab work done, blood tests for hormone levels. But then, instead of primarily consulting doctors, they turn to large language models, AI tools like Perplexity AI or ChatGPT, to interpret those results and come up with a plan to achieve hormonal balance.
Hormonal balance. What does that actually involve in practice, according to this trend? The sources mention it goes way beyond just taking supplements.
Oh, yeah. It's presented as a fundamental lifestyle overhaul. The focus is very holistic, centered on minimizing anything perceived as a stressor, both internal and environmental.
Like what?
Core practices include things like extremely strict sleep prioritization, often meticulously tracked with devices like an Oura ring. And then there's this diligent avoidance of so-called endocrine disruptors, meaning things like swapping out polyester clothing for organic cotton, avoiding household cleaners or plastics thought to contain forever chemicals like PFAS, and generally pursuing pretty aggressive stress reduction techniques. Anecdotally, many women involved in this report significant improvements, things like chronic acne clearing up after making these kinds of comprehensive changes.
And the birth control pill itself has become a sort of villain in this narrative.
It really has. The pill, once seen as this symbol of liberation, is now often framed by influencers as masking underlying problems or having harmful side effects, sometimes based on misinformation.
Is there truth to the masking idea?
There can be. The pill can suppress symptoms of underlying hormonal issues, like PCOS or chronic inflammation. So when women stop taking it, those underlying issues can surface, and they have to figure out how to navigate them. The real problem arises when they turn primarily to non-evidence-based treatments promoted by influencers, rather than working closely with medical professionals.
What are doctors saying?
Doctors are urging extreme caution. They emphasize that biologically, there's really no such thing as balancing your hormones. Natural hormone function is all about constant dynamic fluctuations and rhythms, not some static balance. They warn this whole craze is creating a huge market for untested supplements and potentially harmful self-treatment plans.
Speaking of what's going on inside our bodies, that leads perfectly to one of the most genuinely mind-bending biological ideas in the source material, microchimerism. The idea that our identity isn't just our own DNA.
Yeah, this concept really challenges our basic understanding of self, doesn't it? The article introduces it through this incredibly weird criminal case out of Alaska. Investigators found DNA at a crime scene that perfectly matched a man who was already incarcerated when the crime happened.
How is that even possible?
It turned out the incarcerated man had received a bone marrow transplant from his brother years before. Those transplanted cells, his brother's cells, had replicated throughout his body, mixing their DNA signature into samples like saliva or semen. Wild, right?
Completely wild. But that's a specific transplant case. The article suggests microchimerism is actually much, much more common, like almost universal.
That's the amazing part. It's presented as the biological reality of pregnancy. The science journalist, Lise Barniot, explains it beautifully. During pregnancy, fetal cells routinely tunnel through the placenta into the mother's body, and they don't just disappear. They can persist for decades, embedding themselves in various organs, even the mother's brain.
Wow. And does it go the other way, too? Maternal cells into the fetus?
Yes, it does. Maternal cells also slip through into the fetus. So the biological reality is that mothers carry cellular traces of their children, potentially for the rest of their lives, and children carry traces of their mothers. We're all walking, talking mixes.
So we're biological composites. But didn't scientists used to view these other cells as potentially harmful, like foreign invaders?
That was the initial thinking, yeah. For a while, scientists linked higher rates of these microchimeric cells to things like autoimmune disorders, theorizing that maybe the mother's immune system was attacking these foreign fetal cells. But the understanding has really shifted.
How so?
The prevailing view now, according to the article, is that these cells aren't just passive stowaways or invaders. They might actually be active participants, potentially responding to biological distress signals to provide help.
Help how?
There's evidence they might help repair damaged maternal tissue after pregnancy, or even play a role in training the baby's immune system to recognize and fight off infections later in his life.
That's a completely different way of looking at it. Not invaders, but helpers. Integrated parts of a larger system.
Exactly. It's this profound idea that our physical individuality is far less distinct than we assume. That we're fundamentally these kinds of chimeric meta-organisms, potentially designed for mutual biological support across generations. It really forces you to reconsider what identity even means at a biological level.
If your body contains cells with DNA from your mother, your children, maybe even older siblings from cells left in the mother, yeah, what does individual truly mean?
It's a deep question, a powerful example of the hidden biological complexity that underlies our sense of self.
Okay, let's zoom out from the complexities of the human body to the complexities of global geopolitics. Specifically, how China is apparently using its dominance in key supply chains as a strategic weapon. It goes way beyond just rare earth minerals.
Right? Oh, far beyond. The sources argue China has systematically built control over several critical industries, giving it the ability to, quote, impose pain or threaten rival economies whenever it chooses.
How did they build this dominance?
It's described as the result of decades of deliberate industrial policy. Things like massive state subsidies to their own companies, aggressive intellectual property acquisitions, sometimes legitimately, sometimes not, and strategically flooding global markets with low-priced goods to drive foreign competitors out of business. Once they achieve dominance, they can then use things like export controls as leverage.
Okay, let's get specific. The article highlights three key areas where this dominance poses a direct threat to economies like the U.S. First up, lithium-ion batteries.
Right. Batteries are absolutely fundamental today for EVs, for grid energy storage, for all our consumer electronics. And China essentially controls the entire processing pipeline.
How much control?
The numbers are stark. China controls something like 98% of the world's refined graphite needed for anodes, about 63% of refined lithium, around 80% of refined cobalt. And the two biggest global battery manufacturers, CATL and BYD, they're both Chinese companies.
So how do they weaponize that control?
Beijing can, and sometimes does, require export licenses for specific technologies related to battery manufacturing equipment or critical cathode materials. It gives them a potential chokehold over the entire supply chain needed for the clean energy transition.
Okay, area number two, mature semiconductors. Not the super advanced chips, but the older ones.
Exactly. These aren't the cutting edge chips, but they're the workhorses. Essential for everything from defense systems and cars to washing machines and medical devices. China accounts for about a third of the global production capacity for these mature chips.
And the raw materials.
Even more critical there. For the underlying minerals needed, like gallium and germanium, China's dominance is overwhelming. In 2024, they produced something like 99% of the world's gallium, and they're the top producer of germanium too. And last year, China announced export restrictions on both of those critical minerals.
Have they actually used that leverage?
Yes. There was an instance cited where China temporarily blocked the export of mature chips made by a Dutch company called Nexperia. This happened right after the Dutch government took control of Nexperia away from its former Chinese parent company. It was seen as direct retaliation, a way of testing just how far they can push that leverage.
Okay. And the third area mentioned is pharmaceuticals. This sounds particularly worrying from a public health perspective.
It is deeply concerning. While the final pills you buy at a U.S. pharmacy might not say made in China, China supplies the vast majority of the essential ingredients, the active pharmaceutical ingredients or APIs or the precursor chemicals needed to make them.
For common drugs.
For very common drugs.
Yeah.
Think acetaminophen, the main ingredient in Tylenol, ibuprofen in Advil and Motrin, also critical antibiotic ingredients. China has signaled its awareness of this leverage, too. Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, Chinese state media explicitly suggested that if China restricted exports of medical supplies, the U.S. would be, quote, plunged into the vast ocean of coronavirus.
That's chilling. Have they actually restricted drug ingredients like that?
They generally haven't pulled that trigger in a major way, but the vulnerability is clearly there. The U.S. healthcare system has this built-in profound dependency on Chinese manufacturing for basic medicines, making it susceptible to supply disruptions, whether intentional or accidental. It's a significant strategic vulnerability.
That kind of geopolitical tension is directed outward. But the sources also describe a really grim form of internal exploitation happening within Russia, linked to the war in Ukraine, this phenomenon of black widows.
Yeah, this is a truly disturbing sociological fallout from the war. The Russian government is offering huge sums of money as compensation to the families of soldiers killed in Ukraine. These payouts can exceed 14.5 million rubles. That's up to 200,000 USS.
$200,000 in Russia? That's
an enormous amount of money. It's nearly 20 times the average annual Russian salary. And this huge potential windfall has tragically attracted criminal elements, specifically women who target soldiers, sometimes working with gangs, for sham marriages, purely to collect these death benefits.
Sham marriages? How does that work? The sources give an example.
Yeah, there was one astonishing case detail. A soldier got married literally the day after he enlisted. The ceremony took just 20 minutes, only one guest present. His new wife apparently continued living with her ex-husband the whole time. But when the soldier was killed in Ukraine shortly after, she received the full $200,000 payout.
How did that come to light?
It only got investigated and eventually annulled because the soldier's sister-in-law suspected something was wrong with the timing and circumstances and raised the alarm. Russian courts are now facing this incredibly difficult task of trying to determine intent after the fact. Was a marriage genuine or was it entered into solely for the money?
Are lawmakers trying to address this?
They are. They're proposing new legislation to specifically deny payouts in cases where a sham marriage can be proven. There's even talk of introducing criminal liability for the women and any facilitators involved in these schemes.
And it's not just individuals acting alone. There are organized gangs involved.
Yes, the problem seems to be systemic in some areas. One gang mentioned specifically sought out single, often vulnerable men. They'd persuade them to sign military contracts, arrange these quickie sham marriages, and then convince the soldiers to grant power of attorney over their finances and bank accounts. The gang netted millions of rubles this way before they were eventually prosecuted under organized crime statutes.
Wow. And these huge payouts are having other effects, too.
Yes. They're reportedly flooding into the poor rural regions where many of these soldiers come from, and that's exacerbating existing family tensions. Estranged relatives, like fathers or grandparents who were never involved in the soldier's life, are suddenly showing up to claim a share of the death benefits. It's just compounding the tragedy of the war with this layer of deep societal corruption and conflict.
Such a grim story. We see violence and corruption having major political consequences elsewhere too, particularly in Mexico, following the assassination of Mayor Carlos Manzo.
Yeah, Carlos Manzo, he was the mayor of Uruapan. That city is a really critical hub for Mexico's huge avocado and lime export industry worth billions. He was gunned down while attending a religious ceremony.
And he was known for taking a strong stance against the cartels.
Very strong. He was known for personally confronting the endemic extortion that plagues that region. He would often lead police raids himself, famously wearing his bulletproof vest and cowboy hat. He became a real symbol of resistance against the gangs.
So his assassination puts immediate, intense pressure on Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum.
Immense pressure. Manzo had actually publicly criticized Sheinbaum's security strategy, which she calls hugs, not bullets.
Hugs, not bullets. What does that mean in practice?
It's a policy focus more on intelligence gathering, addressing the root social causes of crime, and generally trying to avoid direct, bloody, militarized confrontations with the powerful cartels. Manzo, however, argued for a much tougher approach. He basically said, criminals who resist arrest should be killed if they don't surrender immediately.
A much harder line. How did the public react to his killing?
Huge public outrage. Massive protests erupted. Thousands marched in his funeral procession, demanding the federal government take swift, decisive action against the Jalisco cartel and other rival gangs that effectively control large parts of that state.
Is there a fear this could lead to something worse, like vigilante groups?
That's the primary concern voiced in the sources. That this kind of failure by the state to protect its own officials, especially outspoken ones like Manzo, could pave the way for the return of heavily armed civilian self-defense groups, or autodefensas. These groups emerged before, years ago, to fight the cartels when they felt the government wasn't doing enough to stop extortion, kidnapping, and murder.
How is President Sheinbaum responding to that pressure?
She seems resolute in sticking to her strategy. She's adamant about not returning to the hardline, militarized approach of previous administrations, which she blames for causing an unprecedented explosion of violence in the past. She did accept a U.S. offer for help with information and intelligence gathering related to the assassination, but firmly rejected any kind of U.S. intervention on Mexican soil.
A very tense situation. Okay, finally, in our look at global conflicts and strange political dynamics, we have what might be the most bizarre story of the day. This weird battle over the body of Zambia's late president.
Yeah, this one is truly strange. It really illustrates how incredibly deep political rivalries can run to the point where they're literally fighting over a former leader's corpse.
What's going on?
So Edgar Lungu, the former president of Zambia, he died recently while seeking medical treatment in South Africa. Now his supporters, who are political opponents of the current president, Hakainde Hichilema, have bizarrely co-opted a famous English soccer anthem.
A soccer anthem? Which one?
Three Lions. The one with the famous line, "It's coming home."
It's coming home. How are they using that?
They're using the phrase, "It's coming home," as a political rallying cry to demand that Lungu's body be repatriated from South Africa back to Zambia for burial. The song is apparently being played and danced to in Zambian nightclubs and on the radio specifically to celebrate court rulings in Zambia that have ordered the body's return.
Why is there even a dispute? Doesn't the family want him buried at home?
Apparently not this family, or at least this faction of it. Lungu's family members are actually fighting in court in South Africa to keep his remains in Johannesburg. Their claim is that Lungu despised the current president, Hichilema, so much that he explicitly barred his rival from attending his funeral.
So the current president wants him buried in Zambia.
Yes, President Hichilema wants Lungu buried in Zambia, specifically at the official presidential burial site, framing it as a matter of national unity and respect for a former head of state. But the Bring It Home faction, Lungu's political supporters, they see his remains almost as a political trophy. Bringing his body back against the family's wishes is seen as an act of resistance against Hichilema's government.
This sounds incredibly bitter. What happens if the family loses their appeal in South Africa?
The Zambian government has basically threatened to proceed with the burial in Zambia without the family's involvement if their final court appeal fails. It's gotten that acrimonious. Even David Baddiel, the comedian who co-wrote the original Three Lions song, commented that he's seen it used in many weird ways, but using it to fight over a dead president's body might be the most bizarre one yet.
It really underscores how political fights can just take on a life of their own, turning absolutely anything, even human remains, into a charged symbol.
Absolutely. An incredible snapshot of political intensity.
What an incredible range of stories. The sheer density of information we've managed to process today is something else. Maybe we should wrap up our deep dive with a quick look at some key corporate and financial news. Q3 results, strategic shifts.
Sounds good. Let's start with Harley-Davidson. They reported a higher third quarter profit, which sounds good on the surface, but a lot of that boost came from their financial services arm, lending money. The core business, actually selling motorcycles, that remains pretty soft globally.
And what are they blaming for the soft demand? The usual suspects.
Pretty much. High interest rates making loans more expensive, general economic uncertainty, making people cautious about big discretionary purchases like a high-end motorcycle, and ongoing inflation concerns. They also specifically called out the financial hit from global tariffs cost them about $27 million just in this quarter alone. So multiple pressure squeezing them.
Okay. What else? There was news about Associated British Foods. They own Primark, right?
That's right. AB Foods, big conglomerate, owns the huge Primark clothing chain, but also a bunch of major food brands like Twinings Tea and British Sugar. The news is they are seriously considering a corporate split, breaking the company up.
Why would they do that? Does it fit that trend we've seen where investors prefer simpler companies?
Exactly. It aligns perfectly with that broader investor push for pure play companies over the last decade or so. Investors generally find it easier to value and benchmark businesses that are focused on a single sector.
And Primark is the giant part of their business.
Yeah, Primark accounts for nearly half the group's total revenue. It's a massive, well-understood fashion retailer. Mm-hmm. But the food side, Twinings, Silver Spoon Sugar, all that has historically been kind of overshadowed, maybe less understood and potentially undervalued by the financial markets. AB Foods seems to think a split could attract new investors specifically interested in either fashion retail or food ingredients and lead to better market efficiency overall.
Even if some parts, like British Sugar, are struggling right now.
Apparently so. They mentioned British Sugar is having a tough time due to weather impacting beet harvests and some market pressures. But the strategic logic for a split seems to be about long-term value realization across the different businesses.
Okay, let's quickly run through some Q3 earnings results for other big names.
Yeah.
Pfizer, still dealing with the COVID hangover.
Still managing that transition, yeah. Overall profit and sales were lower compared to last year because of the steep drop in COVID product revenue. But interestingly, their core sales, if you exclude the COVID-related products, actually rose about 4%.
So some underlying strength. Did they give any forward guidance?
They did offer a little bit of optimism. Despite the overall sales decline, Pfizer actually raised its full-year adjusted earnings guidance slightly. So maybe seeing some stabilization or growth in the non-COVID parts of the business.
What about Molson Coors? Beer and beverages?
Not such a great quarter for them. Molson Coors actually swung to a significant loss, and they missed their sales projections for Q3. As a result, they warned investors they now expect to hit only the low end of their previous full-year financial outlooks. Seems like ongoing pressure in the beverage industry.
Okay, and finally, Rivian, the EV maker.
Rivian had a pretty strong quarter, actually. Their revenue jumped an impressive 78%. That was driven by delivering more vehicles and also getting higher average selling prices for them.
Are they profitable yet?
No, they still posted a net loss, which is pretty common for EV companies still in their high growth phase. But that big revenue jump significantly beat Wall Street's expectations. It signals some real momentum for them in that luxury adventure EV space, even with the broader economic headwinds we've talked about.
Good for them. Any other quick corporate notes?
Yeah, just one more quick safety item. Stellantis, they make Jeep, Chrysler, Dodge. They recalled about 320,000 hybrid vehicles, mostly Jeep Wranglers and Grand Cherokees, and some Chrysler Pacifica minivans.
Why the recall?
Concerns that the high-voltage batteries in these plug-in hybrids might fail and potentially cause a fire. They advised owners to park the vehicles outside and away from buildings until they figure out a fix. Just another reminder of the ongoing safety and engineering challenges that come with scaling up electric and hybrid vehicle technology.
Absolutely. Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today, extracting just a huge depth of detail from those desperate multi-billion dollar bids for Metsera's potential obesity drugs all the way to these really profound constitutional questions at the Supreme Court about presidential power and tariffs.
It's true. And, you know, as we went through it all, a common thread seemed to emerge, didn't it? This feeling of information overload, maybe, but also this deep human search for identity, for security, in a world that just feels constantly disrupted.
How do you mean?
Well, think about it. We see AI investment literally remaking towns like Umatilla, bringing prosperity, but also anxiety and loss. At the same time, that same AI is driving white-collar layoffs, potentially fueling the next big political backlash.
Right.
Geopolitically, we see China weaponizing its control over the basic building blocks of the modern economy, the supply chains. While here at home, the Supreme Court is grappling with whether the president has this almost unchecked power to reshape global trade using laws meant for something else entirely.
Yeah.
It all feels very unstable.
It really does. It feels like knowledge, and maybe even more importantly, adaptability, are maybe the only reliable currencies left in this environment. We talk quite a bit about how AI-driven efficiency is cutting those corporate jobs, potentially creating this new wave of political discontent among disillusioned but very capable college graduates. We even saw hints of that in Mamdani's win in New York.
And that really brings us to the critical question, the provocative thought maybe for you, the listener, for the learners of today. If that old promise of white-collar security through education is evaporating, if AI really is automating many of the tasks we were all trained for, how do you adapt? How do you focus your skills and your learning now?
The challenge is to not just be affected by the change, but to drive it.
Exactly. How do you ensure that you become one of the architects of this new AI-driven economy? Providing the critical thinking, the synthesis, the strategy, the human insight that hopefully machines can't replicate? How do you avoid just becoming one of its victims, someone whose job gets optimized away by the next algorithm?
That is a powerful and maybe essential question to wrestle with. And it's certainly a reminder of why staying informed, staying curious, and diving deep into the news like we did today is just so crucial.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, November 5th, 2025.